Next case of the morning is number 12-20107, United States versus Baker, and I will, as I stated at the outset, I know Mr. Flores and Mr. Peterson better than they want me to. Mr. Flores. Are you court appointed?
No.
Oh, okay. We were wondering. Thank you.
Like to pay us extra, we'll take it.
I bet your client would like that too.
May it please the court. With the panel's indulgence, my co-counsel, Mr. Peterson, and I will divide the argument for reversing Kendrick Baker's conviction. I'll address sufficiency and 404B, and Mr. Peterson will address the Batson issue. Our first submission is that the court should begin its sufficiency analysis by recognizing that because of the extraordinary way this case was prosecuted, there is no precedent that decides the legal question of how to prove this statute's falsity element with this kind of proof. And so we submit the following answer, that to prove falsity in a 7206 case like this, you need a witness with two things. One, they have to be familiar with the taxpayer's underlying financial circumstances. And two, they have to have the ability to navigate the portions of the tax return at issue. Now, the rule that we set is a low bar. If the government had conducted an audit, like they do 1.5 million times a year, they'd have evidence that meets our test. If they had dispatched an IRS agent to investigate the underlying financial circumstances directly, they'd also have that evidence. They'd have the evidence if they had gotten someone from the local H&R Block to come sit and listen to these taxpayers testify and then opine about how a tax return should have been done properly. But there's nothing of that sort in this case because of a fault in their approach. And the fault is that the prosecution's questions didn't realize the fundamental difference between what the taxpayers claimed on Schedule C and what they disclaimed at trial. Or to state it differently, the question that is asked on a tax form like Schedule C is very different than the question asked by the prosecution. One comes in layman's terms, and the other is backed by a very complex legal regime.
But don't you have to, on Schedule C, don't you have to identify your business?
You absolutely do, Your Honor.
But right. And each of those people, as I understand it, got up on the witness stand and said, I didn't have, you know, Babe's Baubles and Beads. I didn't have, you know, Roy's Resale.
That's correct.
What more do you need to know? It didn't exist.
Well, that doesn't prove falsity for two.
And then they all got money back, right?
They did, Your Honor. It doesn't prove falsity here for two reasons. Number one is that the kind of mislabeling you're referring to isn't what the conviction here is for. The government pitches this is that the falsity is the number that occurs in the blank, not the label they put on the business. But the second reason is that when you ask a question like, do you have a business named X, these taxpayers weren't competent to understand what kind of business or sole proprietorship qualifies to be claimed on a Schedule C. So when the prosecution pointed and said, do you have something, you know, that you can fill out a Schedule C for named this, they, in fact, weren't qualified to give an answer like that. So they certainly gave answers, but they weren't qualified to do so.
And were a proper objections raised at trial?
To the admissibility in almost all cases, but our objection here is to sufficiency. And as the Huffman opinion notes and others do, those are two separate issues. We definitely made the objection to sufficiency with a Rule 29A motion. And so those same ideas about the lack of qualification here go to sufficiency as well as admissibility.
Assuming we allow the testimony of the undercover FBI agent or whatever he was, what would be the deficiency in his testimony about showing falsity, Velmo?
The deficiency is that that testimony was not admitted to prove falsity. It was only admitted to prove the intent element and a lack of mistake. And so we have no quarrel with the district court's ruling.
Well, lack of mistake.
That's right, Your Honor, but I don't think that proves that the numbers on the return were false. So, for example, a true lack of mistake defense here would be the case where, consider like a cocaine conviction. You prove that he was actually carrying cocaine across the border, but the defense is, I thought it was flour. That's not the kind of defense we have here. Mr. Baker didn't defend by saying, I confused something. He never denied that he wrote those numbers on the paper. The element at issue in sufficiency is, are the numbers true or false? And Baker certainly says that, yes, I intended to write those numbers, and those were the true numbers because the taxpayers gave me the information.
And did the undercover agent say, but those aren't the numbers I gave him?
In that case, yes, that's right, Your Honor. That's why we think the conviction came out as it did, because of the undercover investigation. But that was admitted to prove falsity, and I don't think the government argues it as such.
Well, regardless of why his testimony, Ruben Rosales' testimony, was introduced, is what he said comparable to what was asked of these eight taxpayers? He was shown the form, the Schedule C, I guess, and there were specific expenses for insurance, for office materials, repairs, maintenance, supplies, et cetera. And Rosales said, I never discussed that with Baker. Did the same routine go through with these eight taxpayers? And were they told, when you, this X charge here for some business expense, did you identify that to Baker? Is that in the evidence for these eight taxpayers?
It is, Your Honor. There were three kinds of questions that would happen. One question would be, did you have that expense? The prosecutor would point to a line and say, did you have that office expense for Schedule C? And the answer would be no. Another question would be, did you tell Mr. Baker you had that expense? And those are typically how it went. But the question that never got asked of any of these witnesses was, are you familiar with what Schedule C allows to be claimed? Anything about what the law requires or any familiarity in that circumstance?
That wasn't developed on cross-examination?
It was developed to the contrary, Your Honor. Our side proved in almost every case that these people had no idea whatsoever what a Schedule C could be claimed for or not.
But Mr. Baker testified, didn't he?
He did, Your Honor.
So what did he say about Schedule C?
He claimed that each of these Schedule Cs was legitimate because of the information that he had about the taxpayers.
So he said they had these businesses even if they said they didn't.
That's right, Your Honor.
Couldn't the jury decide?
The jury could certainly decide to disbelieve Mr. Baker, but remember, it's the government's burden here to affirmatively prove falsity. It's not enough simply to say Mr. Baker doesn't have a good reason for this. They have to actually affirmatively prove the falsity in this case.
But did the government ask these eight witnesses, here's an expense on Schedule C. Did you discuss that with Mr. Baker? Did you have that expense? Why is that an expert? First, is my premise right? And secondly, why do you need an expert to say that?
Your premise is correct, that those are the questions asked, but you need an expert to say that because an ordinary person can't tell you what number goes in the line of a Schedule C with their ordinary experience, right? I think we know this simply by common sense because of the number of people that use TurboTax or a tax preparer, or if you get audited, why everyone has a sense of fear, because people can't answer those questions with certainty beyond a reasonable doubt without going beyond the paper. Remember, the threshold question in this case about whether you can file a Schedule C in the first place is subject to, by our count, 62 federal statutes, hundreds of regulations, and opinions that go all the way up to the Supreme Court where you decide, is this a hobby or is it actually a business you can claim? It's a quite complex legal question. And so that's why, like your own Huffman opinion says, Your Honor, that if it exceeds their everyday experience, then we're talking about a Rule 702 question. And once you decide that, I don't think the government disputes that anyone had the qualifications to give an expert opinion in this case. On the 404P point, the only point that I think deserves the most emphasis.
Why wouldn't the undercover agent's testimony be intrinsic rather than extrinsic evidence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, how do you mean?
Why wouldn't the undercover agent's testimony be intrinsic rather than extrinsic, therefore negating even a need to consider Rule 404B?
I'm not sure I follow your question. The intrinsic, extrinsic.
It's part of the fraud. It's not something that's a separate bad act.
Ah, I see. Well, this occurred long after the transactions in question. So I think that's one reason that it wouldn't apply. And again, I think the district court ruled here that it can only be applied not to the element of falsity, but just as to intent. And so I think to have that kind of application, the government would have to cross appeal, I suppose. I don't think they contest that the question is whether it's relevant to just intent or lack of mistake.
Are we allowed to find that it's intrinsic rather than extrinsic if the government didn't raise that issue at trial? They didn't raise it here.
We believe not, Your Honor.
I'm not surprised at your answer.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you. May it please the court. In response to a Batson challenge, it is not enough for the prosecution to provide an explanation for its strikes that is neutral on its face, although that's all that's required at Batson's second step. In Batson's third step, it's also necessary to survive scrutiny that the reason be neutrally applied, that is, applied the same way to minority jurors who the government struck and non-minority jurors who the government, well, in this case, did not strike. The test for this is what courts refer to as a comparative juror analysis, and it's powerful evidence that the court should grant the Batson challenge. We have not located a single case in which a court has found that the prosecution's reason was not neutrally applied and nonetheless found that a Batson challenge should be denied. Here, the stated reason for the prosecution's strikes of the two Hispanic jurors was disclosure problems on their juror information forms. As the government describes in its brief, these two jurors purposefully failed to disclose requested information and refused to answer simple questions on their form. The government reasons that this raised concerns that these jurors would follow other instructions from the district court. Now, juror 18's disclosure problem was writing in a for grown children's type of work on her form. Juror 25's disclosure problem was writing paraprofessional for her occupation, and the government explained that it was unfamiliar with that occupation. Now, to begin with, I think it's unclear whether the government's stated reason even applies to juror 25. She answered all of the questions, even if the government didn't understand one of her answers. It's very difficult to characterize that as a refusal to answer questions or to infer from that that juror 25 might refuse to follow instructions.
Do I understand correctly that these two were peremptorily struck by the defense or by the prosecution?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so they were not the ones who sat as alternate jurors throughout the trial?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. And as far as number 18 went, her non-disclosure, I think it's a she, she did not identify the professions of her adult children.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, that's sort of unusual, isn't it?
It's somewhat unusual, although if you look through the forms, there are other cases where NA is also written as none.
Yeah, but that's because they were all minors.
Well, not just on this question. Other cases where a juror wrote in answer to a question, for example, magazines that they read, and the only way of understanding that is none. We think 25 might be the better comparison, but the right answer, I think, is to look at this not in terms of the specific information, that is the grown children's type of work or the occupation, but the disclosure problems as a whole. And that's because the government has consistently treated both of these together as examples of a single explanation for its strikes. The stated reason was disclosure problems. Now, these two had different disclosure problems. But I'd point you to Snyder versus Louisiana, where the stated explanation for a strike was a minority juror's potentially missing his student-teacher obligations. When the Supreme Court conducted the comparative analysis, it didn't look for other jurors who would miss their student-teaching obligations. It looked for other jurors who would also suffer hardships as a result of serving on the jury.
How many persons were in the binari?
In the veneer panel used to select the primary panel, it was 30 jurors, two were excused for cause.
So that left you 28. And of the 28, six were what would be classified minorities?
No, Your Honor. What Mr. Nichols explained was that there were only three minority jurors on the primary panel. He identified juror 18, juror 25, and juror 28, and that's at pages 842 and 843.
I thought two blacks got on the jury.
They served as alternates. Those were jurors 31 and 34.
So how many were on the Veneri panel?
Including the alternates, a total of five.
Now, yeah, but they're not designated as alternates when they all come into the courtroom, right? They come in as 33 jurors, and the first 12 will be however many the, no?
With the way that strikes were exercised in this case, the district court divided the panel into two separate panels. One would be used to select the jurors who would serve.
Just make it complicated.
That was how the district court conducted the jury selection process. So there were separate four jurors that were used to select alternates. So as it turns out, there was a double strike of juror number six, for example. Juror 29, I'm sorry, juror 30 did not actually end up serving on the jury either as an alternate or on the primary panel because of that.
And the peremptory strikes used against the two persons about whom you complain, did they engage them in voir dire? Did they question them, or were they just peremptorily struck without being questioned?
Peremptorily struck without being questioned. And that's one of the points that we think discredits the prosecution's explanation somewhat. As the Supreme Court recognized in Millerell and this court in Reed versus Quarterman, if the government believes it's missing information, it should ask about that information.
But did the how much interrogation did the judge allow the parties to conduct?
Not a significant amount. It was a fairly compressed voir dire, although Mr. Nichols was able to call up Juror 7 when he had some additional questions that he wanted to ask of that juror. There's no reason to believe that the government couldn't have done the same, and these would have been very simple questions to ask. Juror 25, what is a paraprofessional? Juror 18, what are your grown children's occupations?
So basically the only individual voir dire was by calling the person up to the bench? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. There was some additional voir dire conducted by the attorneys, but there was room for additional questioning after that time expired.
I haven't heard anything in your statement so far about the clear error that we review this under and whether the judge's explanation was well-founded under that standard.
Judge, as we understand it, when the prosecution's reason has not been neutrally applied, a district court commits clear error by denying the Batson challenge. I think Snyder versus Louisiana is perhaps the best case for this. What this court said in Bentley Smith is that the decisive question will normally be whether a proffered race-neutral explanation should be believed. And when the race-neutral explanation has not been neutrally applied, when it has been applied to minority jurors but not applied to non-minority jurors, then that explanation cannot be believed. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Okay. You have time for rebuttal. Ms. Wilson?
May it please the court. This case is very straightforward. Baker is essentially trying to inflate the complexity and retry the case. There was a plethora of evidence to support the jury's verdict. And, of course, as this court knows, that's the applicable standard of review for sufficiency.
The plethora standard?
No, in light of the jury's verdict, but when the court, of course, looks under that, there is plenty of evidence. Expert evidence, expert testimony in this case was wholly unnecessary.
Let me ask you about what might be a foundation for Mr. Flores's approach to this. Did Baker testify, or was there other evidence of whatever quantity, that he was given business records or personal records of these taxpayers from which he could have garnered this information that was a mystery to his taxpayer clients, where he could have determined there was this expense or that expense, even if the taxpayer didn't recognize it?
I don't believe so. A lot of these taxpayers had little to no evidence. We're not talking about sophisticated taxpayers. For 1 year, they went into an HEB kiosk. The other couple of years, he was in a storefront. These were people that were making, let's say, roughly $20,000 to $40,000. They did not have sophisticated businesses.
Well, let me ask, did Baker testify that he had gotten something besides their oral statements, records from which he may, when you're dealing with burden of proof, where he could have gotten some of this information that they did not recognize?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
W-2s. I'm sure he got W-2s.
Well, right, of course, W-2s, but the W-2s were legitimate. They were for their actual, whether they taught or they were a liquor distributor or what have you. But, for example, let's take the first witness, Mr. Lotsu. All of a sudden, he had a business called Lots of Stuff, which, of course, he testified that he didn't have. There were other businesses. Knowledge is king. So what he would do is he would talk to them, and then he would create a business, if you will, that had something to do with their actual profession. I laid all of that out in very, very detailed statement of facts, including the line items and the Schedule Cs. But the starting point in this analysis, first and foremost, is whether or not these businesses existed. That's not subject to expert testimony. We're not talking about something very sophisticated here. And whether a business exists or not, who knows best but the owner of that business? And these people categorically testified they didn't have this business. It was an outright lie that they had the business on their returns. And everything else flows from there. It doesn't matter whether these people knew they had a what a Schedule C is or what it's not. If they don't have the business, they don't have the expenses, they don't have the losses and what have you, it doesn't matter. And as you can see in my statement of facts, these people were getting back significant amounts of money in comparison to the amount of money that they were paying taxes. And this court has accepted taxpayer money in the past in Staten and in Clark. And Baker's cases are very different. They're tax evasion cases and things that are very, very sophisticated. And that wasn't the case here at all. All of this was within the realm of the jury. So they didn't need the sophisticated tax knowledge. They're entitled to use their common sense and their common knowledge. Nor did they need an audit. That is not an element of the crime. And as Judge Barksdale, you were on the panel in Mutakenye where the tax preparer tried to argue something along those, I didn't mail the tax returns or I didn't send them off or something. And this court said that's not an element, nor is an audit. And particularly in a case like this, you're not going to see, in my guesstimation, the IRS auditing a whole lot of people that make $20,000, $40,000. So in any event, the elements of the crime were satisfied here, and the taxpayers chose to believe the eight taxpayers who testified, and they did not choose to believe Baker, who also testified.
Had the taxpayers been given immunity?
No, they had not been prosecuted, and I believe the answer was at this time. It's probably safe to assume that they were not going to be prosecuted.
I just think that's very interesting, because if I were a taxpayer and they called me to testify against my tax preparer, I'd get pretty nervous.
Well, but they did. Eight of them were there for 16 returns, one of whom had one return. The others all had two or more returns. Unless this court has more questions on the sufficiency, I'm going to move to Beecham, which...
Well, tell us about the... Go ahead. That's what...
The 404B.
Yes.
The first thing I'd like to say is the agent's investigation was not long ago, as Baker's counsel represented. It was 1 month after. And the Judge Miller made that finding, and it's also in the record, I believe, but in the motion for new trial order on page 588, Judge Miller makes that point. So we're talking about 1 month after all of this was going on, because we're talking about the tax years 2005 through 2007, and the investigation was in February of 2008. So that's right within this time period.
When you say 1 month after, 1 month after what?
After the time period stopped.
Meaning the end of the tax year of the latest tax year that was relevant.
Yes, that's what Judge Miller said on page 588. And Judge Miller was exceedingly conscious in this case, both here in the 404B as well as in the Batson. Judge Miller held a 404B hearing before he would admit the testimony. And he heard from both sides at length. He studied the transcript, those are his words, and, quote, he reviewed all of the authorities, unquote, and he listened to the tape, which he also found difficult to understand. Only then did he determine that it was admissible as to Baker's intent and his lack of mistake, not his character. The court later affirmed this also in the motion for new trial order. Extrinsic evidence, this offense involved the same intent as the charged offense, and the jury could find Baker had committed the extrinsic offense. Classic Beecham. And it was the correct decision, because Baker is the one who put these issues in dispute. He repeatedly denied doing anything, knowing it was false, or with the intent to violate the tax laws. And I offered several record citations of that on page 61 of my brief. Also, in opening, Baker's attorney told the jury that they were going to have a royal battle on the last four elements of 72062. So they were engaged on all of those issues from the outset. As this court knows, under Oligan, his guilty plea put his intent at issue. So we had the Beecham, I believe, balancing test also satisfied, because the court could look at all the circumstances. And it found that the evidence would not consume a large portion of the trial, and also it wasn't a more serious offense. And to protect against any potential prejudice, the court said it would, and then subsequently did, issue a limiting instruction, which Baker never objected to. Further support for the court's decision outside this jurisdiction is the Fourth Circuit's decision in Johnson, which I cited in my brief, Cadet and Oskowitz, all of which were preparer-type cases. And the case that they rely on, this Jackson case, the court was very clear in that case about the difference in for intent and conspiracy. But one of the classic differences in the Jackson case was Jackson said, I wasn't there, I didn't do it, I had nothing to do with the crime. Here, of course, Baker never contends that. He fully admits that he was the tax preparer. So Jackson just has no place here.
Did the agent testify about these events, or did he just introduce the tape and then the tape was played for the jury?
He testified about his investigation, about Agent Rodriguez testified about that.
And then they played the tape.
Yes, okay. Which Judge Miller had said would be difficult to understand, but I believe the transcript was there as a demonstrative evidence but was not allowed into the jury.
Obviously, the government felt this was extrinsic and not intrinsic evidence, so you wouldn't have asked for it to be admitted under Rule 404B, but why do you view it as extrinsic rather than intrinsic?
I asked myself that, Your Honor, when I was preparing for this case, but since I didn't try it, I really can't answer it. I think it would work either way. And since it was offered extrinsically, I believe that we are bound to that. And that's what Judge Miller's finding. That was the analysis. And so it's too late. So I understand that. But alternatively, any of the error was, and to the extent this court finds error, it was harmless. There was overwhelming evidence of his guilt based on the testimony and tax materials.
Well, let me ask, what does this really add? And I guess a flip side of that is this in a way supporting Baker that the eight actual taxpayers did not fully close the deal on what was stated on Schedule C? It seems to me the way that you're arguing the case is that the Schedule Cs were fully explored and explained and would support the conviction of the eight actual taxpayers. So what is it that made this evidence important?
I'm not certain I understand what you mean by close the deal.
Well, you're talking about intent, absence of mistake. And your argument in the brief, and I guess to some extent up here, is that that was all nailed down and the evidence that you submitted through the eight taxpayers. So I'm wondering in a little bit if that's true. What the importance of this evidence from the undercover agent was?
Well, I think what you had here, again, is Baker's attorney saying it was going to be a royal battle. The jury can believe or disbelieve the taxpayers. That's their prerogative. But the intent was engaged. Not his character, but his intent and absence of mistake, which, as I mentioned, also in the order on the new trial, which I understand doesn't deal with the 404B. It's just shedding additional light on there. But what was important was Baker was denying both of those things and then subsequently testifies to that as well, which obviously mitigates against a lot of the arguments he's making here.
Well, let me ask, was there something different about what the undercover agent said than what the taxpayers said? Did he in some way, this was what he, the undercover agent, did he in some way, would you argue, made it clearer? I mean, it seems to me from what you're arguing is that for the eight taxpayers, things were on their returns that they did not tell Baker. And that was the same evidence that you got from the undercover agent. So what is different about what came from the undercover agent that would help prove intent or absence of mistake?
Well, I think what's different is the jury was able to hear Baker actually doing the things and saying the things that he argued he had not done.
What wasn't this part of the way the agent was setting up what had happened?
Exactly.
I assume that one of these $20,000 a year taxpayers didn't go to the Department of Justice and say, oh, my, they filed a false tax return. It went the other way. The fellow went into the storefronts.
Right.
Probably went into 5, 10, 20, 30 during tax season in order to develop this kind of evidence, right?
Yes.
That chicken came before the little eggs.
Right. And so he's saying, let's assume we believe him for a moment. He's saying, well, I talked to Mr. Lotsu, for example, and he led me to do this, that, and the other. I was actually working in good faith here. Well, of course, the taxpayers negate that testimony, but the jury hears it from the agent itself, and that's why it was 404B, but the jury was specifically instructed that it could not consider it for Baker's character. And Judge Miller clearly followed this court's edicts, in fact saying that he had reviewed all of the authorities before making that decision. And so that's why it comes in under 404B, or alternatively, it's harmless error. Unless you have additional questions, Judge Southwick, I'm going to move to Batson. Is that okay?
Sure.
Well, Batson, as I believe it was Judge Jones pointed out, we're under a clear error standard here. And the real dispute, of course, is the third prong. That is whether Baker proved purposeful discrimination. And said another way, whether intentional discrimination motivated the government. The district court said no, and so should this court. The district court plays a pivotal role, as this court's decisions have said time and time again. Snyder, a case that Baker often cites, recognized that the best evidence of discriminatory intent is demeanor. And there's decisions upon decisions from this court saying that credibility and demeanor are uniquely within the district court's province. And that was the case here, and this court should defer to Judge Miller. No exceptional circumstances apply. We're talking, of course, about jurors 18 and 25 because they pretty much have dropped the other juror. The prosecutors, the seasoned prosecutors, were very concerned about the refusal to answer questions.
Who were the prosecutors?
Charlie Escher and Jimmy Sledge.
And were they, how did the judge conduct the voir dire?
Well, the judge conducted, if you will, more like an old Texas judge in the sense where he did the preliminary instructions and asked them various questions about how they felt about the government, the IRS, and the types of questions that are relevant, if you will, to this case. And then each side had a turn to ask some questions. And when the strikes were made and Baker's attorney complained about it, what the prosecutors made very, very clear was the refusal to answer these questions, that they were not race motivated, and the adherence to court's instructions is very important, as evidenced by the Rule 404B discussion that we just had. The jurors have to be able a prosecutor has to be able to trust that a juror will follow the law. Any judge does, any litigant does. And so that was the concern here. And they stressed that they were not racially motivated. And that was proved out, if you will, by the fact that they did not strike an Asian and they did not strike the two blacks. Judge Jones, you made the comment about how the panel, if you will, was segregated in the sense of the numbers. And the reason that was is because of Baker. It wasn't because of Judge Miller. It was Baker's choice. Judge Miller at the outset said, okay, we're going to have an alternate whatever. What I like to do to make sure everybody pays attention is not choose an alternate until the very end. And we'll do it by random drawing. And that way we have all eyes and ears on the evidence. And Baker is the one who objected to that. He said, no, I want to go the old-fashioned way.
Well, was the panel sitting in front of him when he made that decision?
I was trying to remember that as I was sitting here today.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot remember that, truthfully. Okay. I suspect not, but I don't remember. But they almost blew through all of these jurors. If this court looks at the 35 veneer members, you will see that the last one was stricken, number 35. So this isn't a case where we had 80 jurors with a few minorities sitting way, way, way in the very back. We could have easily, the minorities, to the extent wherever they were, they could have been reached. Baker's attorney complained from the outset that he didn't think that the panel represented a cross-section of the community, if you
will.
Was
that Mr. Nichols?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Mr. Escher said, or Mr. Sledge said, that it did. But regardless, Mr. Nichols recognized how the federal court system selects juries. And he said, gee, you know, if you were to go with me on this Batson issue anyway, what I'd want to do is I'd want to seat one of the jurors who has been stricken and put them on there. That was his solution. He was very upset that there weren't any African Americans on the jury. But the government did not even strike the African Americans. And who knows, an African American could have wound up on the panel if Mr. Nichols hadn't insisted that they handled the alternates separately from what they're calling the primary panel. I see that I'm almost out of time, but the point that I really want to stress
here. What did Judge Miller say about all this?
Again, Judge Miller was exceedingly conscientious. He wanted to look at everything during lunch. He made it clear before he issued his order that he takes Batson cases very, very seriously, that he had looked at the juror information form and all the associated type of materials that he should consult. And he did find that while it wasn't compelling, he did use the word not compelling, that purposeful discrimination had not occurred, that Baker had not met his burden. And that's where the burden lies, at Baker's feet. And he also pointed out that the government had not stricken the Asian or the two African Americans. And as this court has said in Turner and all these other cases, the district court is in the best position to evaluate the trial court's demeanor and attitude, if you will, towards all of this. So,
well, I think their argument is other jurors didn't fill their forms out completely, and so since they didn't fill their forms out completely and they weren't struck, then you can't strike those for the same reason that they didn't fill out their form completely.
Well, if I may,
they're claiming that's just a black letter law now.
Well, they're incorrect, and here's why. They complain about 3 and 4 not being stricken. 3 had a 13-year-old daughter. Obviously, she's not a grown child, so they couldn't answer that question. Number 4 was 21 years old, and thankfully, it was impossible for her to have grown children. In relation to 29, Baker has conceded that the juror had followed the instructions you could actually put a line through something you purposefully did not want to answer. And from looking at these NAs, I've looked at them very carefully, Your Honor. I think there was some type of computer thing that you could do, which is clear if you look at how the juror forms are. And so a lot of them put NA. I think they were responsive, but the reason it goes N/A is something with this computer form. But I disagree with what they're saying. I don't think that's a correct reading of these juror information forms. And to that extent, I would caution the court that when they're looking at anything that's been typed about, have you ever been served on a suit, been sued and all this type of thing, that the way this computer seems to be working is those answers are very close to a line. And so at first I thought that they hadn't even answered that, but that was incorrect. But if you look at these forms very carefully.
Well, I think we have your argument.
They bear out.
Running over.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Which one of you is going to go first? Mr. Peterson?
May it please the court. I'm puzzled by the government's adherence to the refusal to answer questions rationale for its strikes, because that rationale simply does not apply to juror number 25, who fully answered all of the questions on the form. The only problem with juror 25's form that the government has ever pointed to is that they didn't recognize what her occupation was. That is not a refusal to answer questions. That is not a suggestion that she would fail to follow the district court's instructions. With regard to the credibility of the prosecutor's explanation and demeanor, I'd point you to United States versus Robert Williams. That's the 2001 United States versus Williams case, where the court pointed out that only where the government's reasons are plausible, the inquiry boils down to whether the government should be believed. So, for example, imagine that the government has given an implausible explanation, say the long hair of the jurors in Perkett versus Ellum. At that point, there are two credibility determinations that the district court might make. The first is whether the juror actually had long hair, and obviously that's something this court would defer to. The second is where, assuming the long hair explanation explains the prosecution's strikes, whether the district court actually believes that is the real reason or whether it's simply a pretext for discrimination. But where the prosecution explains that it struck a Hispanic juror for, say, long hair, but didn't strike non-Hispanic jurors for long hair, that's not a reason that explains the strikes. With regard to clear error, Judge Jones, we don't think the district court necessarily had to find for Mr. Baker at that point, but what the district court should have done is continued the inquiry. If the prosecution's reasons had not been neutrally applied, at that point the district court could have pressed the prosecution and asked, why did you strike juror 18 and 25 and not strike juror 16 and 29?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Flores.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to 404B, my friend for the government is certainly right about the time frame of the investigation that occurred here. But that doesn't change the legal rule to be applied, which is that you have to measure the incremental probity of the evidence here. And as you suggested, Judge Southwick, the case was going to rise or fall on the taxpayer's testimony. I think the harmless error argument that the government makes exposes this, that in fact it added very little other than if you used this undercover investigation evidence to infer that how it happened there is also how the events happened, as opposed to mental state.
If my theory is correct, that this was how they, you know, that the jury was owed some explanation about how they even found this out, and I assume that this agent makes a practice of going to storefront tax preparers at tax time and presenting his info and seeing whether they generate a false return or not. Is that correct? Is that what he explained?
He may have explained that, but remember, Your Honor, they've offered this to prove Mr. Baker's intent and his lack of mistake, not the purpose that you just described. So if that was valid, they would have had to proffer it for that. And for the purpose...
No, but I'm not saying that. I'm saying you put the agent's testimony in the context of the prosecution, and maybe I'm wrong because I have not read the record, but he would explain to the jury, I'm sure, how it was that they, you know, I'm sure they had to subpoena these people or subpoena the tax baker's records pertaining to the people for whom he had prepared returns, right? And he had to explain, how did you get interested in his returns?
Sure, that may be well taken, but the question is still whether whatever probative value that has is substantially outweighed by the prejudice. And so we think the point still remains that it should be excluded. Now, if I can, on sufficiency, I want to say one thing about Judge Southwick's question, which is on whether there was some, whether an issue in the case was whether there was a basis for Mr. Baker to make these conclusions, and we submit that there was. Baker's position was that he had the information given to him by these taxpayers, and we give you the citations on page 17 of our brief. The issue was whether or not it was properly accounted for in a Schedule C, and that, we say, required some type of special knowledge under 702.
Okay, thank you very much. Court will stand in recess for 10 minutes.